Hi again, it's Doug here with this week's Staff Pick podcast. And this time we have an interview from the writer and comedian Elna Baker. This was back in 2012. I can't believe it was that long ago. Anyway, you might know Elna's work or her stories on the program This American Life. I actually think she started as a subject of a story, but these days she's an executive producer for the show. Anyway, what interested us about Elna were her stories about being Mormon. As she described it in her memoir, a 20-something Mormon virgin in New York City. And as you'll hear, she's really funny and honest about her experience with faith and why she decided to leave. Here it is, our conversation with Elna Baker from February of 2012. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It was the year 2000 when Elna Baker first arrived in New York City, and in the memoir she wrote a few years ago, she confesses she was already on the fence about her Mormon faith. She had been raised LDS. All of her immediate family was in the church, but she was hoping New York would offer her another kind of identity. In addition to being Mormon, she wrote, "I was Elna." Turns out for a long time, being Mormon was the thing that did define her in a city where people go to be unique. The stories she would tell about trying to stay close to her faith and still live an active social life in the city were genuine and funny. Many of you have heard the stories on programs like This American Life and The Moth Radio Hour. A lot has happened since she wrote the book. Her relationship with Mormonism has changed. Today in the program, Elna Baker is joining us to talk about those stories and the ones she's telling these days. Elna Baker is the author of the book, The New York Regional Mormon Singles Halloween Dance. She has performed at comedy venues throughout New York City and told stories, as I said, for The Moth, This American Life, Studio 360. She's also the co-host and co-creator of The Talent Show. It's a live variety show in New York City. And I'm told she holds the record for most party hats worn at once. Elna Baker, that's a long introduction. Welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, I wanted to, I wanted to start here. I know that you're headed in different directions creatively. I mean, beyond just telling stories about being Mormon in New York or not being Mormon in New York. But I mean, that was such a part of your identity. I'm wondering if it's hard to talk about all of that anymore.
It is. And actually, it's funny. This is probably the first interview I've really given to talk about it. At first, I was afraid to open up about it, just because it's hard on my family, it's hard for my parents, and it's put a strain on our relationship. And that was, I think, one of the reasons it was difficult to leave the church was out of respect for everything it had given me.
It's so interesting to hear you say that, because your book is so confessional, and the stories you tell are so completely honest, but this was the one thing that you really felt unsure about talking about, I guess.
About not being Mormon?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think that it's been a challenge for the last 2 years to figure out where my place is in my own creative world. And in the sense that I always told stories about whatever I was going through and was very honest about them. But the stories were something I felt my parents could listen to or my family could listen to. And when you stop living a PG-13 or PG life, it's harder to talk about those things without worrying that they'll get back to your parents.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's so funny. I never thought that I was, you know, in college you'll have the friend who's like trying to get good grades for their parents. And you're like, come on, grow up. I never thought I cared what my parents thought about me until I stopped doing what my parents wanted me to do.
Do you think it was a surprise for them in some ways? I mean, it's interesting because in some ways you grew up in a pretty conventional Mormon life. I mean, your mother in particular, very conservative. Your father, very devoted, you know, conventional Mormon in some ways too. But, you know, you traveled so much. So in some ways it was conventional. In some ways it kind of wasn't at all.
Yeah, actually one of the things I wrote about in my book was, you know, because we were from Washington State originally. A lot of my family's in Utah. And then when I was 9, my father got a job overseas and we moved overseas. And my parents were so excited to see the world that they would just pack us up in the van and we would drive all over Europe from country to country and go to all these places. And it was this wonderful way to experience the world and learn about history by seeing it. And yet, as we've all grown up and, you know, not necessarily chosen conventional Mormon lives, my father at one point sat my sister and I down and said, "Did we do you a disservice by showing you the world? Because now when we want you to make these simple choices, mm-hmm. the choices that we believe would make you happy, you're not capable of doing it." And I do think that when you have unlimited options, it is harder to choose one thing.
How did you and your sister respond to your dad?
Well, I think it's a hard thing to respond to, because you're essentially saying you regret giving us everything you've given us in our life because we didn't end up choosing the exact path that you and mom chose. And I think that to me, everything that my parents taught me in terms of being willing to say yes to the world or go out and experience these things, it was all with this grounding or anchor that I could do all this stuff as long as I stayed Mormon.
Yeah.
And yet the skills that they taught me were the very skills that helped me reason with myself and decide that it wasn't right for me to be Mormon. And I still think that a lot of that stuff that you learn at church about free agency, or that these are your choices, or the notion of progress, all of that help me have the courage to step away from the faith.
Did you know, I know you went to New York to, part of the idea anyway was to study acting. Was that sort of the passion that you felt when you were young? Did you think about writing as well? I mean, what was it that you figured what was the fantasy that when you thought about you, that you wanted?
I think it was it's simple in the sense that you aren't exposed to that many creative things, right? So initially I thought SNL was really funny and I wanted to move to New York and, you know, be a comedian.
Yeah.
And then I got there and the more, you know, you enter that world or the closer you get to those things, the more types of comedy, types of performance you're exposed to, and you begin to find your home with that. And I never thought of myself as a writer. In fact, I wrote an article for Elle magazine, and through that got the chance to write a book. And when I had this opportunity to write a book, I definitely felt this huge weight on my shoulders, because in my mind, I totally bluffed. I told them I knew how to write, and suddenly I got the chance to. And, you know, it took 2 years of only doing that, not having really any social life, and kind of going into a place of solitude to figure out how to write.
It's interesting you say that. In the early days, when you were first arrived in New York, that you didn't, like, it seems like you figured, I'm going to go to New York and I'm going to just sort of, it's a test to see whether I will stay, because you confess to having these doubts about Mormonism even in those days. And you say that when you went to New York, you didn't let loose. Like you said, it made you want to be true to yourself more in some ways. What do you figure that was about?
Well, I think there were two aspects to it. One was that I was going to NYU, and NYU, especially, you know, 18-year-olds all moving to the city for the first time, each of them sort of felt like this lost child, or that they were that kid in high school who was the different kid.
Yeah.
But then being different became like a commodity, and everyone was trying to show exactly how different they were, and by virtue of doing that, they were all exactly the same. Mm. And there was this thing that still is the core of who I am, which is that I see the world through the lens of being a Mormon.
Right.
And that makes you see things differently than other people do. So I think I clung to that. And then I also, my first Sunday in New York, I went to church. And I, you know, I had always felt restless at church, or, you know, try to find ways to, you know, I would, you know, kick and scream on the way there. But going to church that first Sunday in New York, it was so familiar. And it felt so safe. And it was like going to a family reunion. You know, you don't necessarily like all your relatives, but you're related to them. And it made me want to go back. And so I went every Sunday until I stopped practicing.
So what was the part, do you think, that... So it seems like it's the community part that was really appealing in some ways. But I wonder, what about the... you know, the beliefs themselves, or the teachings themselves, that I guess what part of it was the part that was appealing to you? Was it like the Joseph Smith story, you know, the origins of the faith? that he had these visions and that he translated, you know, this book from these ancient golden plates. Was that a part of the thing that you felt like made you Mormon, or was there something, you know, kind of beyond that that you took from Mormonism, if that makes any sense?
Absolutely. Actually, it wasn't the community. The community part was what made it feel familiar in New York, but I always had a hard time with the community because I felt like, you know, I didn't grow up in Utah. I didn't know these cultural references. I grew up Mormon overseas, and when you're Mormon overseas, there's all these, you know, people who have joined the church, there's missionaries, there's these small branches, and people, in order to teach the gospel, they teach the very minimal sort of core ideas of love and forgiveness and the atonement. And I think for me, the reason I was Mormon so long, and the thing I miss most about being Mormon, even though it's still sort of there and I'm trying to figure out a current relationship to this aspect of me, was that I loved God and I loved having this person that I grew up every night praying to and that I could share my thoughts with and who I felt like was guiding me, and that I was, no matter what, going to be okay because I had a relationship with God. And then I think the reason I was Mormon was that I was taught that if you love God, you need to keep his commandments. And so out of that feeling of strong love, I felt like I had to keep doing this, even though it was really hard and went against my own nature or desires or freedom of expression.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I was reading the blurb that Ira Glass did for you for the book. And he wrote this. He said, it's heartbreaking to think that someday she'll have to choose one over the other. And when you first read that, did you think, no, that's not true. I don't have to choose one over the other. Did you think it was inevitable?
It's funny. I felt like a lot of my friends and associates, and it's like people could see me from above and they could see that I was going to end up choosing. But to me, it was a blind spot. I didn't think that I would have to choose. I wanted to be able to make it work. And I think I possibly could have. In my mind, if I just met the right Mormon guy who was liberal enough and married him, I could still be in both worlds. I think that's why I put so much emphasis on meeting somebody at church or marrying somebody at church, was I felt like that was the only way I could stay Mormon, was if somebody else made me, which is a terrible thing to do to someone that you love.
So I actually wondered this. Do you figure that if you had... because you came to Utah for a time, not very long, but in the book you talk about the experience where you fell in love with a guy, and this was sort of happening, and you came to Utah and you lived, I guess it was in Provo, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I just wonder would the influence of having more Mormons around you more often, would that have made a difference? It sounds like it wouldn't have.
I don't think it would have, in the sense that, I don't know, some people, like my older sister is practicing, and it always just suited her nature. She just liked being good.
Yeah.
I feel like I don't really like being good. No, that's not entirely it. I feel like there was my dad used to always say to us, when we were supposed to, you know, he'd be like, go do the dishes. And we'd say no. And he'd be like, all right, well, there's the easy way or there's the hard way.
Right.
The easy way is you do the dishes. The hard way is you complain, I spank you, you do the dishes, right?
Right.
And so I always chose the hard way. And I still always choose the hard way. And I think that once I get comfortable in any situation or feel like I understand it, I start to test it or push it or try to understand it better. And for me, the hardest part about being Mormon that no friend could have saved me from, no marriage could have saved me from, was that I wanted to know if it was true or not.
Right.
And if it was true, I would do it. But if it wasn't true, I wanted to accept that I could live any way I wanted to, or that there were other paths. And so I think that for all those years, to me, it was a really theological struggle.
Hmm. It's interesting because your father had his doubts, and he told you about this, and he also had this this big moment when he was 19, wondering whether he should go on an LDS mission, and that thing that happened to him, this spiritual experience, seemed to kind of confirm everything that he thought, and none of the doubt he told you that he's had since has really undermined that one big moment. And you write about in the book that you were looking for that moment too, what you call the point of no return. And you had moments mm-hmm. of kind of spiritual peace and calm, but it didn't, I guess, did it ever rise to that level for you at all?
You know, it did. I felt like I had big enough spiritual, and again, this is like a very, very particular to Mormons.
Yeah.
Just this notion that if you lack wisdom, ask God. It's right. The Joseph Smith story. So that any of us can do that at any time. And so every few years I would feel like I can't keep doing this, and I would pray for a big spiritual experience, and I would get some sign or some glimmer of hope that was strong enough that I felt like it didn't come from me and that it was worth still being Mormon because I had that sign. But then when I was 25, I did meet another Mormon at church, and, you know, he had talked about he was going to ask me to marry him, and he wanted me to move to Utah for him. So I went to the temple in Manhattan, and I was so unsure about whether I wanted to do this, but I prayed, and I felt like I got this big response that was, you know, God telling me, yes, yes, go do this, yes. And then when I moved to Utah, and it all just went horribly wrong, and it was clear that I didn't want to do this, and I felt like I was dying. A few months later, I look back at that answer that I got in the temple, and it suddenly occurred to me that I had answered myself, and that I had felt so much pressure to marry another Mormon from my family, from church, from just the idea that that's what you're supposed to do as a young woman in the gospel, that I had led myself astray and told myself it wasn't me doing it.
Yeah.
And I think that unraveled a lot of my understanding of my own spiritual motivations and where my answers were coming from. And I tried to ignore it for, you know, another 2 years, tried to ignore that realization. But eventually, I think that was the straw that broke the camel's back.
Did you ever wonder if this was the same, this was the thing that explained your father's experience too, that... You know, that was his own thing. Do you know what I mean? I mean, do you ever, I guess the question is, do you ever kind of question the way others close to you, like your dad, have come to their own kind of testimony, is the way the Mormons put it, I guess. But do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. I do question it, and I do hear it through this new lens or way of hearing things, where I can think, oh, well, I wonder how they came to that conclusion, or if that was a divine revelation from God, or what outside sources or pressures could have pushed them to think that that was the answer they needed to get. But I also think that I don't like to spend time doing that. I love that people believe things. I think it's beautiful, and I think that if the outcome is positive and if they feel peace from it, who am I to say that that's, to nitpick at that?
Yeah. You know, it made me wonder, when the book came out and you were on, book tour, and you were talking to people about, I mean, there was a different premise. I mean, we're left at the end of the book not knowing, some sense that this may happen to you. You may lose faith, but you were still sort of clinging to it at that time. It seems like by the time the book came out, you were pretty sure it was inevitable that you were going to lose faith if you hadn't already, I guess, by that point. And it just made me wonder how you talked about the book at that time when the premise had changed so much.
Well, it's funny because when I was writing the book, the last few months of writing the book was when I decided that I wanted to take a break from being a Mormon.
Yeah.
And I had, I'd read about Rumspringa and the Amish, and I thought, well, I'll take a year, and I can do whatever I want for a year, and then at the end of it, I'll decide if I want to go back or You know, and I think that came out of, you know, years and years of believing that my doubt was a source of disobedience, and that if I had doubt, it was because I wasn't being a good enough Mormon. So anytime I had this overwhelming wave of doubt, I would just try to be a better Mormon. And I kept doing that every few months. I would just try to, you know, make sure I was paying my tithing, or, you know, commit to doing home teaching or all these things. And then finally one day I thought, I don't know what it's like to not be Mormon. And I want to try it just for a year and then decide. And that began a few months before the book was finished and then came out. But it was a really slow break. It was too scary for me to really try and do anything.
Yeah.
So I, you know, I did drink a little, or I tried coffee. That's about it.
But this is, which is completely different from Amish kids, by the way, in rooms. I mean, they apparently go nuts. Or
yeah, meth. They're meth addicts immediately.
Exactly. So what were you? You just figured you couldn't go there, at least not in that way, I guess.
I also felt this pressure to practice what you preach, and I felt like the book. I wanted to write the book from the perspective of somebody who had never had sex, who had never tried these things, because there is this world that you live in when anything is possible because you don't know the outcome yet.
Yeah.
You don't know what those things feel like or how. And I wanted to finish my book only in that place. And then when the book came out and I had to do a tour and get questions and answer them, I didn't want to be a hypocrite. So I felt like for a few months I just kept practicing for the sake of being true, true to it.
Yeah.
And then, honestly, after I think it was like the last tour date or last interview that I did a few months later was when I did end up having sex with the guy I was dating.
Yeah.
And for me, that was, I think, the point of no return, because I guess I had been taught, you know, it's the second most serious sin. And if you do that, it's a huge repentance process. And I felt like in some ways I did it to do something big enough that I would feel like I couldn't return.
You know, the sex part is one thing. And I want to ask you about, when we get back from a break, the experience where you tried to tell your parents about it. But it's so funny how tangible the idea of having a drink is, which I wonder if in some ways only Mormons will completely understand the powerful manifestation of that. Like a drink would be so... you know, so such a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that when I first took a break, it was so hard to do anything because it didn't come naturally. Like, I think anyone who grows up with alcohol or drinking at dinner or just, you know, family parties, you just reach your hand out and you grab the glass. It's not, there's no pause. There's no like, but from where my hand is to where the glass is, there are 80 different thoughts that I've had where I've weighed the decision pro and con and tried to talk myself in and out and wondered, you know, everything it would lead to, when really it's just a glass of liquid.
Yeah. Was there a particular moment when you let go? I mean, you talk about this sort of slow process and there's this kind of realization that you came to, but was there a moment when you knew for sure, you know, that you couldn't stay in the faith?
Well, I think
sort of like your polar opposite testimony. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, actually, there is. It's funny. I was just telling the story out here in Georgia a little bit. It's the first time I've said this out loud and been performing it. But when I went to tell my parents that I was not Mormon, basically, my father said, you know, is it worth it?
Yeah.
And I thought about it, and there was one moment, which is a story I could never tell my father, which felt like, oh, a moment of clarity. And it had happened a few months earlier. I had, when I first started drinking, I would only have one drink because I'd seen Girls Gone Wild and I didn't know how many they had.
Right.
It's like, you know, how many right. till I show my boobs? I don't want to be that girl. But I went to some holiday party and I had, you know, free drinks, at least three drinks or whatnot. And I was there with this guy I had a crush on, and turned out he liked me too. And he said, you know, we started kissing and he said, let's go somewhere. Let's check into the Chelsea Hotel, which is this famed, you know, artist hotel in the city. And, you know, I hadn't slept with anyone. I'd never done anything like that. But I thought, you know, I'm on a break. I'm allowed to do this. So I said, okay, but not for sex. And then we got in a cab and it was like 4 a.m. and we walked. I still remember the sound that my heels made on the marble as I approached the front desk at the Chelsea Hotel. And there was this old woman and her back was to me and she was sorting mail. And I leaned in and I sort of whispered. I was like, excuse me, is it too late to check in? And she turned around and she had a smeared red lipstick, a cigarette hanging out of her mouth. And she just said, actually, most people check in right about now. It was like this whole other world that I had never entered that exists in New York City. And then I went upstairs with this guy and I didn't end up sleeping with him, but it was the first time I was ever, you know, naked with somebody, which was a big deal and can be a really beautiful experience. And then, you know, we fell asleep and then probably about an hour later, the Mormon girl woke up with like a, you know, what am I doing here? How did I get here? This is horrible. How could I have done this? And in the midst of this panic, I could understand that, you know, for me, the biggest fear of not being Mormon was that if I stopped, that my light would go out, you know, because you're taught that God is light and truth and that sin is darkness.
Yeah.
And so the reason it had been so hard to even try to drink or, you know, try coffee or smoke a cigarette, all these things were so hard to try to do because it felt like I was willingly pulling darkness into me. And then being upstairs in that moment and just seeing like the city lights outside and this person that I had feelings for that I was with and, you know, at 28, being naked for the first time, it occurred to me that I still have my light and that I could venture into these things and still make wise decisions and still maintain myself, that I was strong enough for it. And I think that was the moment that I realized I didn't need to go back.
Elna Baker is with us. She's the author of the book, The New York Regional Mormon Singles Halloween Dance, co-host and co-creator of a live variety show in New York City. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West, so thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're having a conversation with the writer and comedian Elna Baker. Many of you have come to know Baker from her stories on This American Life and the Moth Radio Hour. They're stories about her life as a devoted Mormon trying to navigate the world as a young single woman in New York City. She's joining us to talk about finding faith and then losing faith. She's the author of the book, The New York Regional Mormon Singles Halloween Dance. We had a call earlier, Elna Baker, that I couldn't get to for time yet. From someone who wanted to ask, and I'm wondering if you get the same kind of question about how you survive, I guess, as a Mormon. Do you get people asking you for advice?
Well, you know, I try not to be the spokesperson for Mormons, especially now that I'm not practicing.
Yeah.
And I don't really take a lot of the opportunities that I could be given to probably promote my career. Because I don't want to be a false spokesperson, but like when the Book of Mormon musical came out, and you know, it's impossible to get tickets to that show.
Yeah.
Every single news outlet wanted to take me to that show and just hear my thoughts. Or, you know, sometimes, you know, people will email me to, you know, ask if I want to be a talking head about Mitt Romney. I don't know, you know, anything about politics, you know, but just by virtue of being a Mormon, you become... But yeah, it's totally changed, even in the last 10 years. 10 years ago, like, I don't think Mormons were nearly as on the map as they are right now.
Yeah.
And it's only growing. And I also think that one of the things that I'm most curious about in terms of the development of the Mormon church is how they'll deal with people who stop being Mormon. And whether or not, you know, because I think Mormonism is a newer faith, and so that you can be Catholic and say that you're Catholic and not practice.
Yeah.
But if you're Mormon and you stop practicing, you know, I feel weird saying that I'm Mormon, but I also feel like I am Mormon.
Yeah. So when someone asks, are you Mormon, do you qualify it?
I say that I'm not practicing.
Yeah. Does that seem weird?
Awkward? It does seem weird.
Yeah.
You know, or my brother recently stopped practicing and he won't even say that he just says no.
Right.
He's not Mormon.
But what's the thing that makes you Mormon?
Well, it's funny. I think if I were Mormon right now,
yeah,
I would say that just your level of commitment and faith and
right.
And now that I'm not Mormon, I would say it's the perspective that you were raised with.
I want to ask you about a piece, an essay you wrote for This American Life. It was last year, I think it was. Maybe there before. But it was this piece you wrote about the men in Snowflake, Arizona, where your father grew up, mm-hmm. who had this experience. They were part of this logging crew, and one day on their way home, they saw this big bright light, and it turned out, as they tell it, to be the spaceship. And one of the guys in the crew, Travis, says he was abducted and then, you know, sort of experimented on, I guess, and released. And this was in 1975. There's a you know, a film that was sort of based on this. And you tell the story about one of the guys, Ken Peterson, mm-hmm. who went up and wanted to camp at the site. And you went along for This American Life to tell the story. And what you wanted to know, what was it you wanted to... Because there was something you were sort of trying to get at. I mean, you were intrigued by the fact that Ken wanted to go back up and have this second encounter. And you say you sort of figured you understood that desire in some way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I felt like, I grew up around this story, which they made into the movie Fire in the Sky.
Yeah.
And, you know, my Uncle Sank was kind of one of the characters that James Garland is based on. And I grew up with a poster of it in my bedroom, and it's a beam of light hitting this guy's chest. And in the beam of light, Travis Walton, who was abducted, had signed, "Elna, don't go towards the light, Travis Walton." But we also had one of those up the stairs, prints of Joseph Smith receiving his first vision where it's a beam of light. And it had this similar, to me, they had a similar idea. It's hard to connect like alien abduction to faith in God.
Yeah.
But something about it had just this idea of believing something that seemed like no one around you believed.
Yeah.
And yet, in spite of the fact that there's this, you know, my conscience is chained to the will of God, I can do no other, God help me. It was a quote I'd written down once. I think that was Martin Luther.
Hmm.
But just this idea that you had an experience and your conscience was altered and you had to be true to that.
Right.
And you couldn't back down. And I had my first, you know, strong spiritual experience when I was 14 and I went on Trek, which is, you know, the Mormon, you know, youth trip where you hike up a mountain.
Yeah.
And they had told us to go into the woods and pray and ask if God was real. And I did that, and I had a strong enough experience that really anchored me over the course of my life to believing in God.
Mm.
And yet, as I began to lose my faith, it was like I took all these spiritual experiences and I tried to see them with a lens that could talk me out of believing. And then I wondered if these men who witnessed this alien abduction, if they still believed. And so I started, you know, looking or asking around and got their phone numbers and interviewed them and found out that one man, they all do believe, they all still stick to the story, but most of them kind of moved on with their daily lives. It was like, this crazy thing happened and we won't say it didn't happen, but we won't devote our lives to it.
Right.
But one of the witnesses, Ken Peterson, really believes. And he, every few years, will go up and camp out on the site of the abduction. And so I went up to this remote site in the White Mountains in Arizona and camped out overnight on the 35-year anniversary of the abduction.
I want to play the sort of the last moment of that essay from This American Life. Ken, I guess we should say, Elna, sees all of these signs in pretty much everything that connects him back to this experience. And in some ways, I guess you could relate to that. You sort of saw the same kinds of, not the same kinds of signs, but you also were seeing signs that related you back to your experience, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And actually, there's one thing I should say that didn't make it into the essay that I've always found really fascinating, is that Ken Peterson and Travis Walton were camping out maybe a year before this. And, you know, aliens were in the news a lot, and, you know, there were abduction stories. It was very popular at that point, movies made about it. And Ken said to Travis, he said, if you ever, you know, saw an alien spaceship, what would you do? And Travis answered, I would jump out of the car and I would go up to it and I would get a free ride to space. And so a year later, when this actually happened and Travis did jump out, Ken felt like Travis had said that and then the aliens came to get him. Hmm. And Ken also felt like because Travis was ready and ready to act, had already made up his mind, that's what gave him the courage to do it. And he feels like he made a mistake. And so he's waiting for a chance to go there. And everything he's searching or looking for is like these little, you know, it's like he's on a treasure hunt and they're clues. And he just has to see the clues and he'll get there.
Here's an excerpt from Elna Baker's essay for the program This American Life.
It's almost like this is something. Now I'm playing the same game. But the last big like moment that I feel like was the spiritual experience that I had was probably 3 years ago, maybe 4 years ago, where I felt like it was getting so hard to believe for me that I just was like, you know, I want a sign again, like the one I had when I was young. And I just want you to tell me that you're there, God. Mm-hmm. And I knelt down and I prayed and I asked this. And then I looked up at the sky and I was like, the sky, that's the sign. Like anyone can see this. This isn't a sign. I just see, you know, a few stars. It's New York. You see like maybe 5 stars. Mm-hmm. And just as I was saying, like, this isn't anything. This is just what's always there. One of the stars shot across the sky and it was the biggest shooting star I'd ever seen.
I still don't know what to think of that moment. It was shocking. But as soon as it happened, I did the thing I do now. I started questioning. Was that meant for me? Or did I just happen to look up at the exact moment when a star shot across the sky? I'd forgotten about that moment until I shared it with Ken. And it made me think, well, that's an even bigger sign than what I experienced in the woods as a teenager. So really, I have had signs since then. And that's when I realized, I don't just want a sign. I want to be myself at 14 again. The kind of person who believes in signs.
We've been getting a number of different kinds of questions. I hope some of the listeners don't mind me asking some of these for them. One from a caller named Joe wanted to know, so what do you believe? Like, have you changed religion or are you not a believer anymore? I imagine you get that question from time to time now.
Oh, I think it's something I'm finally grappling with. I feel like the first year and a half of taking a break from being a Mormon, in order to take a break from it, it's like I had to actively ignore it.
Yeah.
And in some ways, that's even worse because when you're ignoring something, you are paying attention to it.
Right.
So I went from being somebody who prayed, you know, in the morning and at night, if not more, you know, who really did have a relationship or who talked to God a lot. And I stopped that completely. And, you know, I used to read my scriptures in the morning. I stopped doing that. I stopped going to church. I stopped everything and, you know, pushed it away. And I don't think I even knew how to do anything. Like, I don't think I could meditate. Like, if I tried to meditate, I'd start crying and be like, oh, I'm ignoring everything. So I think for a good year and a half, I just ignored it all. And now that I feel like I've gained a little bit of strength in who I am and more stability, because I think it was just shocking to change my identity so much.
Right.
And now that I feel like I'm standing on my own 2 feet again, I've started to try to figure out what I believe. And I don't know. Yeah. It's hard to answer the question. I do believe that there is, I still believe in God. I believe in such, like, I feel like all my answers are so simple and vague. Yeah. You know, they're like, I believe in being good to people.
Yeah. But is it the Mormon God, you know, whether it's Mormonism you believe in, is it the Mormon God that, you know, the, wasn't it a white robe and a big white beard? You know what I mean? Like, do you think of it in that way?
You know, it's hard for me not to think of it that way.
Right.
Like, it's a man that I'm talking to.
Yeah.
But I do try to make it more about a feeling now. You know, like the other day, we were on this Unchained tour, and I pulled my back out, and I was in a lot of pain. And when I used to be in pain, when I was Mormon, I would pray to feel better. And I was in so much pain that I was like, you know what? I haven't said a prayer in a long time. And I just said a prayer that I would feel better. And I burst into tears, and I was like, I'm sorry, God. I'm sorry that I don't talk to you anymore. I miss you. I'm really sorry. I know we're friends. I've been the worst friend lately. And I think it's hard to change. It's hard to change who you are. It's sad. It's hard to be honest with yourself.
Yeah. There's a question from Jeff from Kaysville, Utah, wanted to know if it was anything like, when you told your parents, if it was anything like a gay person coming out. And I think you've said before that it was, in some ways, it's kind of the same speech, or a friend of yours said that anyway.
Yeah, it's so funny. So I flew to Siberia to tell my parents that I had lost my virginity. And part of the reason, you know, most parents don't really want that speech, but in the time that I had, you know, taken a break and ventured into having sex, I was so worried that, you know, if my parents found out, would they disown me? Would it change our relationship? But, you know, so there was that I wanted to address. But also, I'd written an article for Glamour magazine about losing my virginity. Right. So whether I told them or not, they were going to find out. And this article was like super, it was totally butchered. Yeah. It was supposed to be this heartfelt piece about, you know, what it's like to lose your virginity later in life. And then Glamour got their hands on it. And it was called, Guess What? I'm Not a Virgin Anymore. And there's a picture of me dangling a cherry over my mouth.
Yikes.
So I knew it was going to be bad. I knew my parents were going to hate it. And it was coming out the same week as my younger sister's wedding in the Salt Lake City Temple.
Wow.
So, like, I didn't, you know, the last thing, upstage the wedding. You know, the whole family would be like, Julia's getting married. Elna's going to hell. It's just, like, ruin everything. So I flew to Siberia to try to tell them, and I couldn't. I kept trying. There were all these moments, and I would chicken out. I couldn't do it. And I flew back to New York and waited another month, and then a few weeks before the article came out, I called my parents, and I gave them this speech on the phone, which my gay best friend later told me was literally the same speech every gay person gives when they're coming out to their parents. You know, I started by saying, you know, there's this thing about me that I feel like I've been at a distance from you because of, and I need to finally open up and be honest about who I am. I'm not doing this to hurt you. And I still love you. And, you know, that was the premise of the speech.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, there's a question from Emily, who is in Utah County, wants to know if you're feeling, I guess, in terms of the response from your parents or even from other Mormons, like pity, you know, like, oh, you've done the wrong thing. I mean, how were people reacting, I guess, to you? Is pity part of that?
You know, I think my parents have been incredibly supportive and continue to be supportive. I think for them, I think the response from my parents and the response from other Mormons are very different. I think for my parents, it's hard on them. I feel like they feel like they have made some mistake as parents. And I think they wish they could have done something differently.
Right.
Whereas I think the response from other Mormons, it just depends on the Mormon. You know, I think a lot of people are much more supportive than I expected. And I also think that when I was Mormon, I felt like this call or this need to try to express what it meant to be a Mormon to people who didn't really understand. And I lost that when I stopped. But I'm starting to realize that there's a lot of people, whether they're Mormon or not, who have come from very powerful faiths and stepped away from that and feel really lost and confused in that world. And then I'm starting to feel, after 2 years of not writing or telling these stories, I am starting to feel like I could possibly be a voice to that and connect with people on that level and find a purpose in that. Whereas I felt like when I stopped being Mormon, I sort of stepped away from that purpose.
It's so interesting, too, because, I mean, I wonder, in some ways, it's like your devotion is one of the things that kind of made you successful in New York. I mean, being a person from a strict religious culture who leaves the faith isn't really novel in New York, you know, or anywhere else for that matter. Your devotion was part of the thing that made you really interesting. And I'm wondering if you worry about that. You don't have that kind of story to tell anymore, or you just want to put the story aside.
Yeah, I mean, I think I definitely, like, and in different forms, you know, I work in a couple different fields.
Yeah.
So in my pursuits elsewhere, I don't talk about being Mormon. It's just about, you know, comedy or whatever I'm trying to create.
Right.
And I had worried that I had kind of given up my gimmick, you know,
yeah.
or the thing that made me interesting.
Yeah.
And in just the last few months, I've finally gotten up and told newer stories. And I was so afraid that they wouldn't succeed. But the thing that I've discovered is that the person telling the stories has become richer, or they are layered in a way that they weren't before. And that comes across and makes them more human and more relatable.
Yeah.
Because when you're a gimmick, you're more of a novelty. You're a thing to be poked at. And when you understand more of what people are going through, or just as you age, I think that it gives you more to communicate and not less.
You've also written about or talked about the fact that for the last two years, since you haven't been writing any more memoir, that kind of gave you a kind of freedom to sort of live the way you wanted without the fear of having to write about it or reflect on it as, oh, this is a story I can write about or tell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when my book came out, I had all these offers from other publishing houses. They wanted me to write another memoir. And I was like, what? I have nothing left to say.
Yeah.
There's nothing inside of me to possibly say. And then I would think about the opportunity, or I would think, oh, well, I could turn this into the story or that into a story. But then I felt so disconnected from being present in my life because I was looking at things and wondering how I would write about them. And then I realized that I didn't want to write about what I was going through. And I made this conscious choice to just not write or tell any of the stories that I was experiencing and just live. And when I made that choice, it freed me up to make mistakes, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I think if you think you have to write about it, you're not gonna make nearly as many dumb choices. Because writing about it somehow makes you feel like you'll have to be accountable.
What's the stuff you miss about not being Mormon?
I think the thing I miss most is like feeling like I had somebody to talk to all the time. I was never alone. I'd be like, did you see that? Can you believe that? You know, now if you do that, you just feel crazy, like you're a crazy person. I miss family home evening. We used to do that when we were kids.
Yeah.
I miss singing in church. I used to love to sing hymns. I don't ever sing now, but I love to sing, and I would sing once a week. I mean, honestly, sometimes I miss, like, there were so many just awkward things that happened at church that were so funny. It was a real source for humor because I felt like I was pushing against it, but I also felt like I had to be there. And to survive in those sorts of situations, whether you have, like, a job that you hate, oftentimes when you feel like you're forced to be somewhere, your mechanism to survive is your sense of humor.
Yeah.
And so I felt like going to the singles ward, as excruciating as it was, really did, like, sharpen my sense of humor. And actually, one of my friends is telling me that, because I used to get up and bear my testimony almost every testimony meeting.
Wow.
And they're like, you know, that was your way into stand-up. You were just practicing stand-up on this Mormon audience.
Zelda Baker, she's a writer, storyteller, the author of the book The New York Regional Mormon Singles Halloween Dance. She's the co-host and co-creator of The Talent Show. It's a live variety show in New York City. Joined us today from a studio in Savannah, Georgia. Elna Baker, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. I'm Doug Fabrizio.